Historical What Ifs. Historical What Ifs.
History hinges on moments so small they could fit in the palm of your hand, yet their consequences echo through centuries and shape the world we live in today. This is Historical What Ifs, where we explore the alternate timelines that could have emerged from a single different decision, a missed opportunity, or a stroke of luck that went the other way. Today's episode examines one of those pivotal moments and traces the extraordinary chain of events that might have followed if history had taken just one small turn in a different direction. Welcome to Historical What Ifs, reimagining pivotal moments. Historical What Ifs.
It's one of the biggest questions we could possibly ask on this show. How do you even begin to imagine a world without one of its most transformative figures?
You really can't overstate it. What if the Prophet Muhammad had never been born? It's a question that honestly has always fascinated me from a geopolitical standpoint. You look at a map of the 7th century, you see these two colossal, exhausted empires, the Byzantines and the Sasanian Persians. And you realize that the entire subsequent history of the world pivots on what happened next in the Arabian Peninsula.
Exactly. And for me, it's the cultural and intellectual dimension. We're talking about the foundations of a civilization that would eventually give us algebra, advancements in medicine, philosophy that reintroduced Europe to its own classical past. The list is endless. The thought of erasing that, of that entire stream of history, just not being there.
It really is. We're not just talking about removing a single person. We're talking about the potential absence of one of the world's great monotheistic religions. A unifying force that reshaped everything from North Africa to the Indonesian archipelago.
So, the question we're posing today isn't just about an alternate history of the Middle East. It's about an alternate history for the entire planet. What fills the vacuum? What rises in its place? And what does that world, a world without Islam, even look like? That's the journey we're about to embark on.
So let's start with that vacuum, the immediate one. Before we even get to the grand sweep of history, what was the situation on the ground in the Arabian Peninsula in, say, the early 600s? You have this power void between Persia and Byzantium.
It's a tinderbox, really. A patchwork of tribes. You have the Quraysh in Mecca, powerful because they control the Kaaba, this major pilgrimage site. But they're just one player. You have the Jewish tribes in Yathrib. You have Bedouin groups, all locked in these cycles of raids and vendettas. There's no centralizing force.
None at all. And that's the first most critical divergence. Without Muhammad, there's no transcendent message that can supersede tribal loyalty. The appeal to join a universal ummah, a community of believers, that just doesn't exist. So the Aws and the Khazraj tribes in Yathrib, they likely just continue their decades-long feud.
Oh, for sure. The very reason some of them invited Muhammad there in the first place was to act as an arbiter, to end their ruinous civil war. Without him, Yathrib never becomes Medina, the city of the Prophet. It remains a fractious oasis town, probably weakening itself to the point of irrelevance, or being dominated by an outside power.
And think about the document that came out of that move, the Constitution of Medina. It's this astonishingly pragmatic political covenant. It brought together Muslims, Jews, and pagans under a mutual defense pact. It guaranteed freedom of religion for the Jewish tribes. It wasn't just a religious charter. It was a state-building document.
And that state is the engine for everything that follows. Without the Hijra, the migration to Medina, you don't get that political base. You don't get that document. And you certainly don't get the military force capable of challenging Mecca.
So, the Battle of Badr? The raid on the Meccan caravan that turns into this pivotal, almost miraculous victory for the early Muslims? It never happens. The event that in their eyes confirmed divine favor, poof.
It's a complete non-event. And the psychological impact of that is huge. For the Quraysh in Mecca, they just continue their trade with Syria unmolested. Their prestige isn't challenged. There's no existential threat brewing in an oasis a few hundred miles away.
Right. So the entire decade of conflict, of raids, of battles, Uhud, the trench, all of those formative experiences that forged the Muslim community into a disciplined political and military entity, they are erased from the timeline.
Which leads to the biggest geopolitical question, the Arab conquests. This explosion out of the peninsula that overruns the Sasanian Empire and strips the Byzantines of half their territory in a generation. It's predicated on that unity. It's predicated on a single banner and a shared purpose.
Without that, the tribes of Arabia remain a footnote in the great game between the Romans and the Persians. They're proxies, maybe, mercenaries, but they are not the protagonists of their own story, let alone the world's.
So, the Sasanian Empire, which was on its last legs, exhausted from centuries of war, does it survive? Maybe it fragments, but it's not conquered by this new, unexpected force from the south. And the Byzantines, my goodness, they might actually manage to hold on to Egypt and the Levant.
But hold on a second. Holding on to Egypt and the Levant? Is that a given? I mean, we've established both empires were on their knees. The Byzantines were bled white. Could they really have reasserted control over populations that, frankly, didn't like them very much to begin with?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? I think they could have, but it would have been ugly and slow. In our timeline, the Islamic conquests were a lightning storm that hit a house already damaged by earthquakes and floods. Without that storm, the house is still standing, just creaking. The Byzantines would have likely spent the next century trying to nail the boards back on, probably facing constant rebellions from Coptic Egyptians and Syriac Christians who saw them as foreign, Greek-speaking oppressors.
So, the great theological schisms of the day, the Miaphysite and Nestorian controversies, they don't just get swept under the rug of a new geopolitical reality. They become the central, defining fault lines of the entire region.
They become everything. Think about it. Instead of the great Sunni-Shia divide shaping the next 1,000 years, you have the Chalcedonian-Miaphysite divide driving politics in the Near East. Does a breakaway Coptic kingdom in Egypt become a permanent reality? Does Nestorian Christianity, which was already spreading east along the Silk Road, become the dominant force in Mesopotamia and Persia?
Wow. So you're suggesting that without Islam as a unifying, or at least overwhelming force, Christianity itself might have fractured even more dramatically. It wouldn't just be an east-west split between Rome and Constantinople, but a 3- or 4-way split with major power centers in Alexandria or Ctesiphon.
Precisely. And what about the other great power? The Sasanians. Without that final decisive blow from the Rashidun Caliphate, they don't just vanish. They're weak, they're in a civil war, but the state, the idea of Persia, is still there. Does Zoroastrianism get a second wind?
That's a fascinating thought. Maybe as a reaction against the constant pressure from Byzantine Christianity, a new Sasanian king could have rallied support by championing a revitalized, more assertive Zoroastrian faith. It could have become a real bastion, a religious-cultural firewall against the West.
A firewall. I like that. So the map of the 8th century isn't a vast unified caliphate. It's this chaotic mosaic. A struggling, overstretched Byzantine Empire trying to impose Greek Orthodoxy. A defiant Zoroastrian Persia. Maybe an independent Coptic Egypt, and Aramaic-speaking Christian kingdoms in Syria and Iraq. It's far less stable.
Far less. And we haven't even touched on the intellectual consequences. The House of Wisdom in Baghdad, that nexus of translation and preservation that took Greek, Persian, and Indian knowledge and synthesized it. That's a product of the Abbasid Caliphate. It's a product of a rich, confident, unified empire.
It doesn't happen. In a world of bickering, defensive statelets, who has the resources or the vision for a project like that? The Great Library of Alexandria was burned centuries earlier. The intellectual energy of this new world is likely spent on theological polemics, not on translating Aristotle or advancing algebra.
So, the reintroduction of classical Greek thought to Europe, which happened largely through Arabic translations from Spain and Sicily, where does that come from?
Maybe it doesn't. Or maybe it takes another 500 years, trickling in from forgotten Byzantine monasteries. The European Renaissance, if it happens, looks completely different. The entire intellectual trajectory of the West is altered because that brilliant bridge, built by Islamic civilization, simply isn't there.
That's a chilling thought. A brilliant bridge that was never built. And we've only really talked about the traffic going one way, from east to west. What about the other direction? The Crusades, they don't happen, not in the same way. The entire psychological framework of Christendom versus a unified Islamic world, it just doesn't exist.
There's no other to define itself against, at least, not a single monolithic one. The entire concept of the Saracen never enters the European imagination. And think about Spain, Al-Andalus, the Caliphate of Cordoba, one of the most sophisticated societies in the world in the 10th century. Poof, it's just a struggling Visigothic kingdom, probably squabbling with the Franks.
No Alhambra, no Great Mosque of Cordoba. It's staggering to think about the cultural loss. When you really pull at this one thread, the whole tapestry just unravels. It brings me back to what we said at the very beginning. It all hinges on that one initial act of unification in a place everyone else had written off.
It does. And for me, the final takeaway isn't just the geopolitical chaos, as profound as that is. It's the silence. The intellectual silence. The absence of the poetry of Rumi. The philosophy of Ibn Sina. The mathematics of Al-Khwarizmi. It's a quieter, dimmer world.
I see it more as a world of endless friction. A world where these smaller regional conflicts, the Copt versus the Greek, the Zoroastrian versus the Nestorian, never get subsumed by a larger identity. They just fester for centuries. Which I suppose leaves one last nagging question. Does anything ever unify that part of the world?
Or does it become a permanent shatterbelt, a zone of constant conflicts between a resurgent Persia and a tenacious Byzantium? We can't know. And that's the ghost in the machine of this whole exercise, isn't it? We can trace what's lost, but we can never truly know what might have been born in its place.
A world that is, in so many ways, less connected, and I think, less predictable. It's a powerful reminder that history isn't inevitable. It turns on a knife's edge.
A knife's edge in the middle of the desert. What an incredible thought to end on. Thank you for joining us for this journey into what might have been on Historical What Ifs. The butterfly effect of history reminds us that the world we know today is just one of countless possibilities, shaped by moments of chance, choice, and consequence that could have easily gone another way. This has been Historical What Ifs, where every episode reveals how fragile our timeline really is and how different decisions by our ancestors might have created an entirely different present. Understanding these alternate possibilities doesn't just satisfy our curiosity. It helps us appreciate how remarkable it is that we ended up in this particular version of history.